on January 2, 1935. A man arrived at the President Hotel in downtown Kansas City, carrying only a comb and a toothbrush. He requested an interior room on the upper floor of the hotel. He checked in under the name Roland T. Owen, a detail that would become surprisingly relevant to the case. After securing his room on the 10th floor, he briefly departed the hotel, appearing sporadically during his stay. While the man's demeanor raised eyebrows among the staff, they didn't dwell on it too much. The hotel frequently accommodated travelers and businessmen seeking late-night companionship, and the staff preferred to maintain a degree of detachment. It wasn't until days later that the staff's attention was drawn back to the man when he was discovered dead in his hotel room, which had been transformed into a scene of gruesome violence. And little did they know that this was just the beginning of a baffling case that remains unsolved to this day. This is the story of the mysterious man in room 1046.
Stop. This message could save you from investing your precious time into a true crime story that goes nowhere. Avoid that disappointment. You need True Crime Feed Podcast. Unlimited premium true crime curated for you. Find out about a female serial dater turned serial killer. The truth about the DARE program. Bizarre black markets, political murder plots, and a school for troubled teens so horrific it could be a Stephen King novel. True Crime Feed sifts through the archives from the past decade to select the best cases and gives you a quick overview sprinkled with a teensy bit of humor, plus a weekly top three power ranking for shows currently trending, and lets you know what shows to send down your podcast queue trapdoor. You know you want those thrill chills, so come and get them. Subscribe to True Crime Feed. That's True Crime F-E-E-D wherever you get your podcasts.
The Hilton President in Kansas City, formerly known as the Hotel President, stands as a historic landmark renowned for hosting iconic entertainers like Frank Sinatra and Benny Goodman. However, among historians, it's infamous as the site of one of America's oldest unresolved homicides. On January 2, 1935, a man, appearing to be in his mid-20s to early 30s, registered at the Hotel President using the name Roland T. Owen. He claimed that he was traveling from Los Angeles, where he was a resident, described as a tall, robust individual with a distinctive scar above his left ear and a cauliflower ear. He gave the hotel staff the impression that he was a lesser-known boxer or wrestler. A cauliflower ear results from blunt force trauma and commonly afflicts athletes in combat sports like boxing or mixed martial arts. Owen specifically requested a solitary room overlooking the hotel courtyard on the higher floors. He was assigned to room 1046. Randolph Probst, the bellboy on duty, escorted Owen to his room. During their ride in the elevator, Owen mentioned his initial intention to lodge at the Muhlbach Hotel, but opted for the more economical rates at the Hotel President. Probst observed Owen's scant belongings, a toothpaste, comb, and brush, which seemed peculiar for someone staying multiple days. Later that day, Mary Soptic, the afternoon maid, went to room 1046 for cleaning and was taken aback to find Owen sitting motionless in an eerily dark room. All of the blinds were drawn and closed and the lights were off, except for a dim lamp on one of the desks in the corner. For Mary, being in this room was certainly unsettling. After she was done cleaning, Owen instructed her to leave the room unlocked. He told her that he was anticipating a visit from someone. He then put on his coat and left the room. In subsequent statements, Soptic expressed that she was able to notice a demeanor of apprehension when interacting with Owen. She believed that there was a worry occupying his mind. Something important to note is that the Hotel President's door mechanisms differ from the standard in modern hotels. The doors of the Hotel President could only be locked from the outside. For many, this is a practice that appears counterintuitive, This arrangement raises concerns about guest safety, particularly regarding unauthorized entry while occupants are inside and asleep. Nonetheless, that is the arrangement that Owen seemed to have preferred. Soptic proceeded to attend to other rooms before circling back to 1046 to restock towels. Upon re-entry, she was startled to find Owen fully clothed, lying in the darkened room. Adjacent to the sole illuminated lamp, a note read, "Don, I will be back in 15 minutes. Wait." At approximately 10:30 the following morning, Soptic revisited room 1046 for cleaning. She recollects that the door was locked. Presuming Owen had vacated earlier, she used the master key to gain entry. To her surprise, Owen was once again seated in the dimly lit corner of the room, motioning for her to proceed with her duties. Owen then received another call from the mysterious Don. Mary recalls him coldly saying, "No, Don, I don't want to eat. I am not hungry. I just had breakfast. No, I am not hungry." Owen engaged in casual conversation with Mary, discussing the steep rates at the Muhlbach Hotel and inquiring about her duties at the hotel. Curiously, he asked several questions regarding the areas of the President Hotel under her purview. She would leave his hotel after briefly chatting to tend to other rooms. Upon completing her tasks, Soptic returned to room 1046 in the afternoon to replenish towels. As she approached, she overheard two men conversing loudly within. Mary knocked on their door and requested to come in so she could deliver the towels. A man with a deep voice answered and quickly dismissed her. Mary was adamant that the voice did not belong to Owen. That evening, occupants of room 1048 lodged complaints about disruptive noises emanating from the adjacent room. They all claimed that they heard the voices of both a man and a woman loudly conversing. Elevator operator Charles Blotcher interestingly clarified that the commotion likely originated from a gathering in room 1055 further down the hall, dismissing room 1046 as the probable source of the voices. Earlier that same afternoon, the President Hotel welcomed two additional guests, whose arrival would significantly add to the enigma surrounding what transpired in room 1046. The first guest was Jean Owen, unrelated to Roland, who had journeyed to Kansas City to spend the day with her boyfriend, opting to stay overnight rather than make the lengthy drive back to her hometown on the outskirts of the city. She checked into the President Hotel. Assigned room 1048, adjacent to Roland's, Jean Owen settled in for the night. Jean was the guest who had made the noise complaints. The other guest to check in would stand out significantly as a witness. Blotcher recounted to the police that the woman in question was a familiar presence at the Hotel President, suspected by many staff members to be a sex worker due to her frequent visits to various male guests' rooms. He recalled her asking him for directions to room 1026 on the night of January 3rd. He summoned the elevator for her and didn't expect to see her for a while. 5 minutes later, the elevator was called to the 10th floor again. The same woman emerged, frustrated that her client, who was usually very consistent, was not answering the door. She was certain that her client was on the 10th floor, but she gave up searching after more than an hour. 1026 and 1046 are room numbers that one could easily mix up, especially if they're frequenting other rooms. It's possible that Owen was the client the woman was looking for. But whether Owen had any involvement with the woman on the night of January 3rd or contributed to the noise disturbances remains uncertain. However, an intriguing detail would eventually emerge. Investigators learned that an eyewitness spotted Owen outside the Hotel President that night. At around 11 p.m. on January 3rd, city worker Robert Lane was driving along 13th Street on Lydia Avenue. It was at that time that he observed a man, clad only in an undershirt and pants, sprinting down the street, frantically attempting to hail his car. Lane halted his vehicle and lowered his window, waiting for the man to approach. Upon reaching the driver's side window, the man offered profuse apologies, mistaking Lane for a taxi driver. He then requested Lane's assistance in reaching a nearby taxi stand to which Lane agreed. As the man entered the vehicle, Lane noticed his dire condition. The man had a severe gash on his arm, which he was actively trying to cover. Lane dropped the man off at the intersection of 12th Street and Troost Avenue, where the man boarded one of the waiting taxis. Upon learning of Owen's case, Lane approached the police, recognizing the wound on Owen's arm as matching that of the stranger he had picked up from the street. Although hotel staff couldn't corroborate Lane's account, police received credible eyewitness reports situating Owen on 12th Street outside a liquor establishment, accompanied by two unidentified women. And things would only get more strange. Della Ferguson, the switchboard operator for the hotel, was readying the scheduled wake-up call for room 1046 at 7 a.m. on January 4th. While attempting to do so, she noticed the indicator light, a signal that the phone receiver in Owen's room was off its hook. Randolph Probst went to the room to prompt Owen to return the phone to its receiver. After knocking on the door multiple times and loudly, the occupant allowed Probst to enter. Since the door was locked, Probst loudly told the occupant that he needed to fix the position of his phone, and then he walked away. At 8:30 a.m., Ferguson attempted the wake-up call once more, but the phone was still off its hook. Harold Pike, another bellboy, was dispatched to Owen's room. Armed with a master key, Pike entered the room after repeated knocking. That is where he discovered Owen, lying motionless in the darkness and completely naked. Pike quickly returned the phone to its receiver and then exited the room. At 10:30 a.m., another switchboard operator noticed that the phone in room 1046 remained off the hook. Probst was once again sent to the room to speak with Owen about fixing the phone. Equipped with a master key, Probst proceeded to open the door when Owen failed to respond. Upon entry, he found the room enveloped in darkness yet again. After switching on the light, he was met with a chilling scene. Blood was splattered across the bedroom and bathroom, with Owen lying motionless on the bed, soaked in blood. His body was bound with cords encircling his neck, wrists, and ankles. Probst promptly called the assistant manager from the lobby, and together they returned to room 1046. To their surprise, Owen was still alive. Stirred by Probst's sudden departure, he had regained consciousness, but had slipped behind the door. With Owen's help, they gained entry into the room and promptly contacted the authorities. Probst and his manager freed Owen from his restraints and questioned him about the ordeal. Owen offered a simple explanation, attributing his injuries to a fall. When pressed about his assailant, he cryptically responded, "Nobody." Rushed to the hospital, Owen sadly succumbed to his injuries the following morning. The mysterious man was now dead. Doctors determined that Owen sustained his injuries between 4 and 5 a.m. on January 4th. Investigators noted the absence of Owen's clothing and toiletries from the room, the presence of cords securing Owen's body, along with a lack of sharp objects, suggested that his wounds were not self-inflicted. Furthermore, the discovery of a broken glass in the sink and various items such as a hairpin, safety pin, unsmoked cigarette, and a bottle of diluted sulfuric acid scattered around the room only added to the mystery. Investigators uncovered four fingerprints on the room's phone, presumed to belong to a woman, and they couldn't match them to Owen or any hotel staff. With no clear leads, the police turned to the media for assistance, sparking a whirlwind of rumors and speculation. Curiously, Kansas City police conducted thorough searches, but found no records matching the name Roland T. Owen in any California city. It would appear that, whoever the mysterious man was, he was not using his real name. Meanwhile, as the police awaited the results of fingerprint analysis in hopes of identifying Owen, numerous tips flooded the hotline, suggesting potential leads regarding the man's true identity. Police dedicated significant resources to investigating each tip meticulously. One woman alleged that Owen resided in Clinton, California, but this lead only led to a dead end. Another tip suggested that a man resembling Owen had previously checked into the Muhlbach Hotel under the alias Eugene K. Scott. However, a swift inquiry with the hotel debunked this claim. A more promising lead emerged from a man who believed Owen to be his cousin. Upon viewing the body, however, he realized his mistake. It appears that Owen merely bore a strong resemblance to his family member, and he profusely apologized for the confusion. A wrestling promoter named Tony Bernardi recounted an encounter with Owen, who identified himself as Cecil Werner. Owen expressed interest in wrestling opportunities, prompting Bernardi to refer him to another promoter in Omaha, Nebraska. Unfortunately, this lead also proved fruitless. Despite diligent efforts, the case's lead investigators were reassigned to another homicide squad weeks after Owen's body was discovered. With no new leads forthcoming, the case went cold and was soon classified as unsolved. The nationwide circulation of Owen's photos eventually paid off when the police received a promising tip. Ruby Ogletree came across a photo of Owen on the cover of the American Weekly and was struck by the resemblance to her son, whom she had not seen since he departed for California in 1934. Without hesitation, she reached out to the Kansas City Police Department, offering crucial details about her son's distinguishing scar above the ear. Roland T. Owen was positively identified as Artemis Ogletree. Ruby's identification of her son only raised further questions for the police. While she couldn't answer all of those questions, she was more than happy to provide them with what she knew. She disclosed that she had received letters from her son in the weeks following his death. The initial letter, postmarked in early 1935 from Chicago, was typed, a surprise to Ruby, as her son lacked typing skills. Moreover, the tone of the letter differed significantly from Artemis's usual writing style, prompting suspicion. The second letter arrived in May of 1935 from New York, with Artemis purportedly announcing his imminent departure for Europe, claiming his ship was scheduled to sail that very day. Ruby received a call from a man in Memphis, Tennessee, asserting that Artemis resided in Cairo and had married into a wealthy family. The caller added that Artemis had lost his thumb in a struggle while attempting to save his life, thus explaining his lack of correspondence. Collaborating with the United States Embassy in Cairo, police conducted investigations, but found no evidence of Artemis's presence in the country. Regrettably, this marks the extent of available information in the case, leaving a trail of unanswered questions with each new lead. The police were only able to form theories about what could have possibly happened. The prevailing theory implicates a man known only as Don. This theory exists in two versions. The first posits that Don acted alone, managing to enter and exit the property undetected. The loud voice heard by Mary Soptic while returning towels likely belonged to him. The second version suggests that Don had an accomplice, possibly the woman encountered by elevator operator Charles Blocher on the night of January 3rd. Blocher noted that the woman initially sought directions to room 1026, but ended up searching for her client in room 1046. While it's plausible that the woman made a simple error, police discovered fingerprints belonging to an unidentified woman at the crime scene. Neither Don nor this enigmatic woman were ever identified. The second theory emerged several years after Artemis Ogletree's murder. During his funeral, the funeral parlor received instructions from an unidentified caller to enter his body in Memorial Park Cemetery. The caller's sister was buried there, and he oddly wanted Artemis to be buried close to her. The mysterious caller also provided funds to cover the entirety of the funeral expenses. Artemis was purportedly engaged to his sister, and he had been unfaithful to her. Allegedly, the couple convened in room 1046, culminating in a confrontation that resulted in Artemis's death. The caller concluded by ominously remarking, "Cheaters usually get what's coming to them." In 2003, a curious new lead surfaced in the long-standing investigation of Room 1046. John Homer, a local historian at the Kansas City Public Library, received a call from an unidentified individual. The caller disclosed discovering a shoebox filled with newspaper clippings related to the case. Intriguingly, one item in the box was referenced in the newspaper stories of Ogletree's case, suggesting the owner of that shoebox had a connection to the murder. However, the identity of the caller and the significance of the item remain shrouded in mystery, at least to the public eye. Various theories exist regarding the motive behind the crime. Some propose a crime of passion, sparked by an affair, while others speculate involvement with organized crime. The truth of what truly unfolded in Room 1046 continues to elude investigators. What circumstances led to this mysterious man's unfortunate demise? To this day, that remains still an unsolved mystery.